Welcome to The Mind Renewed.
They're so worried that they've got to take over down here the direction of where it's going and get a one world system together. Get rid of nationalities and get one government, one religion, so we won't have war. That's the effort of man to bring about his own salvation.
Hello everyone, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to podcast number 45, In Defence of Norman Baker, Conspiracy Theorist. Now, today's podcast is, I think, going to seem a little bit strange because, in a sense, it's the result of my getting a bee in my bonnet, as we say here in the UK, about something that I heard on the radio last week that particularly annoyed me. So you may hear me sounding a little bit irritated at times, but I guess that's fair enough because it did, in fact, get my goat, as again we say here in the UK. It was a conversation on BBC Radio 4's Today programme between the presenter Evan Davis and his two guests, Mark Pack, editor of the Liberal Democrats newsletter Newswire, and John Rentoul, chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday. And what they were talking about was the somewhat unexpected appointment of British Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament Norman Baker to the post of Minister of State at the Home Office. And all that can sound really very pedestrian, except that Norman Baker in 2007 had published a book about the death of the biological weapons expert Dr. David Kelly, in which he questioned and rejected the official verdict of suicide. Now, as I said, the conversation between these three men I found really quite irritating, and you'll get to hear it in a minute, so I think you'll understand why I feel the way that I do about it. Now, no doubt the producers intended this to be a light piece, but I think if you're judging someone's character as to whether or not you think they're suitable for public office, a far less prejudiced and far more rigorous approach would have been much more appropriate. Indeed, I thought, as a broadcast segment, it was little more than an insult to Mr. Baker, and indeed to any person who cares to think for themselves. So I thought I would respond with an open letter, and that I would use the whole incident in a way that I'm pretty sure the BBC would not like me to use it, as an opportunity to share with you a short lecture that casts an entirely different light on the whole matter. So without further comment, my letter. Dear Mr. Rentoul, Mr. Davis, and Mr. Pack, on the morning of the 8th of October 2013, just before I left the house to take my daughter to primary school, I chanced to hear your conversation on BBC Radio 4's Today programme, in which you were discussing the appointment, the day before, of Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament Norman Baker to the position of Minister of State at the Home Office. I would like to say that I found your conversation enjoyable, or at least informative, but alas, I have to say I found it neither. In fact, I thought it offensive both to Mr. Baker himself and indeed to any thinking person who has a sufficient grasp of political reality to realise that government doesn't always present the public with the whole truth and nothing but the truth on every single matter under the sun. Indeed, I'm reminded of the words of James Angleton, one-time head of CIA counterintelligence: deception is a state of mind, and the mind of the state. But before I address the particulars of your exchange, let me just take a few moments to remind you of both what you said and how you said it.
19 minutes to nine. Of all the reshuffleys yesterday, the most eyebrow-raising, jaw-dropping even, was Norman Baker, the Lib Dem MP, was moved from a post at Transport to the Home Office. Why were eyebrows raised? Because Norman Baker has taken a rather conspiratorial view of one or two security matters. He wrote a book called The Strange Death of David Kelly, the government scientist who sadly took his life after being exposed as a source of suggestions that government had sexed up a dossier on Iraq. Norman Baker suggested he may have been murdered. Here he is talking to Andrew Marr about the case in 2007.
He had been told by a friend who was senior in the security services that this was a, quote, wet disposal. And what was wet disposal? I asked him. Wet disposal means that it was a hurried job and he was killed in a hurried way. That's apparently what wet disposal means.
Actually, that wasn't from him talking to Andrew Marr. That was actually from a programme called The Conspiracy Files. Let's talk to two political commentators about that. John Rentall is a chief political commentator for The Independent on Sunday, and Mark Pack is with us, editor of Liberal Democrat Newswire. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Mark Pack, some have suggested this damages Liberal Democrat credibility. Does it, or...?
I think not at all, because Norman Baker has got a very good record, very impressive record as a minister in the Department of Transport. It's also true he's got some slightly curious, eccentric maybe even, views about the death of David Kelly. But I think what for me is really important is that that is sort of the exception. It's not that he's out there every day, you know, saying there are aliens hidden in the gardens and Buckingham Palace or anything like that. There's one particular issue where he's been hugely sceptical about the official government line. He's sort of put a lot of
David
effort
Kelly.
Himself, exactly, put a lot of effort into digging up information. And actually that scepticism, I think, will be very beneficial in the Home Office.
Mm. John Rentall.
I'm sorry, I can't take that seriously. I mean, this is someone who has taken a year out to write a book about a theory which is so outlandish and so ridiculous that nobody can take it seriously, and to suggest that this isn't going to affect his job as a minister, he is not going to be taken seriously by the Home Secretary, who I understand is absolutely furious about his appointment, and the idea that Home Office officials are going to give him the time of day beyond good morning and thank you very much.
I know, John, you had written a little about his views of the death of Robin Cook as well, and I think you had to post an apology to him for that.
Well, I apologised for briefly taking him seriously, because he did suggest that Robin Cook's death was suspicious because it happened on Ministry of Defence land. He then emailed me to say, oh no, I wasn't suggesting that he'd been murdered. And then I discovered, because I haven't actually read his ridiculous book about David Kelly, because I don't read books, I don't waste my time on books about UFOs or JFK, but David Aronovich has written an excellent book on conspiracy theories and has read it for us, doing a sterling public service, and discovers that in that book he also suggests that Robin Cook there was something suspicious about the death of Robin Cook. I mean, this is not a man who should be in public office.
But I think that's not... in fact, John, if you look at your own sort of apology for your apology that you wrote, actually the words that David Aronovich picked up on were completely innocuous words that Norman Baker had written about, that the death happened shortly after, another event. And that was just... simply a little bit of chronology allegation.
Mark, this is the way that conspiracy theorists work. They suggest, oh no, I wasn't suggesting that. I was merely asking questions. I mean, this is absolutely not the way that serious people should do business.
I should say we did invite him to come on the programme. He didn't particularly want to today. But Mark, in terms of how his relations work with Theresa May, it's going to be terribly frosty, isn't it? It's not just because he's a liberal and she perhaps isn't. It's much more to do with the wackiness of his views on
I think there are many ways of assessing Home Office ministers. Whether Theresa May, or indeed whether Home Office civil servants like them or not, is really not the prime objective you should have going into being a minister in any department. I think, in fact, if you go in thinking, well, I've really got to have the civil servants like me, I've really got to have people from other political parties like me, that's a really bad way of going about doing a job. And I think, John, in that sense, was praising Norman Baker. I know he wasn't intending to, was praising Norman Baker by saying actually how he's likely to be somebody who doesn't immediately become an establishment figure in
the
Home Office.
That much you definitely can say for him. No one's going to say he's an establishment pushover, are they, John?
I don't really know what to... I mean, that is, in a way, that's a sort of conspiracy theorist's approach to government, that you don't actually want people to like you. You want the Home Office...
A bit
which
of
is,
tension.
Of course, which
of
is,
tension,
of course, the root of almost
tension.
All conspiracy theories. You want the Home Office to be against you. I'm afraid it is not the mark of a serious person that he...
Why did Nick Clegg do it, do you think, John Rentall?
I imagine because he had reservations about Jeremy Brown, and he knows that Norman Baker is terribly popular with Liberal Democrat activists like Mark Pack, and Nick Clegg wants to endear himself to the activist base because he knows that his job is on the line at the next election.
Norman Baker, Minister of State at the Home Office. John Rentall there from The Independent on Sunday, Mark Pack from Liberal Democrat Newswire. Thanks both.
Mr. Pack, let me first commend you for defending the appointment and character of Mr. Baker. You say that he has an impressive record as a minister, that he's unlikely to be a yes man in his new role, and that scepticism such as his will be very beneficial in the Home Office. And on those points, let me say, in parliamentary style, hear, hear. Indeed, contrary to Mr. Rentall's remark that Norman Baker is not a man who should be in public office, I agree with you. This is exactly the kind of person we need. Someone who will cast a sceptical eye over intelligence communications that pass across his desk, rather than, as you say, an establishment figure who might be more inclined to turn a blind eye when they considered it politically expedient. But why did you say this?
What for me is really important is that that is sort of the exception. It's not that he's out there every day, you know, saying there are aliens hidden in the gardens and Buckingham Palace or anything like that.
Now, I suspect your intention was to reassure everybody that Mr. Baker's view about the death of Dr. David Kelly are not fairly to be compared to those who believe there are aliens in the garden of Buckingham Palace. For as we know, there are at least some people who think there are aliens inside the palace. But it seems to me your comment is somewhat ambiguous. A casual listener might be forgiven for thinking you meant Mr. Baker's views are indeed that unreasonable, but at least he's keeping quiet about them. What explains that ambiguity? Was it, as I suspect, that you felt a certain degree of peer pressure in that context to distance yourself from the term conspiracy theorist, understood in the derogatory sense? Mr. Davis, was it not your responsibility as a presenter on this programme to encourage a reasonable degree of accuracy and impartiality with respect to the subject under discussion? After all, the Today programme prides itself as being BBC Radio 4's flagship news and current affairs programme. For a corporation which has in its agreement with the British government the responsibility to, quote, do all it can to ensure that controversial subjects are treated with due accuracy and impartiality in all relevant output. So I ask, do you think that you did all you could to steer the conversation along the lines of accuracy and impartiality when you yourself described Mr. Baker's views as wacky, made virtually no attempt to challenge Mr. Rentall's derisive dismissal of Mr. Baker, and implied that it is a matter of historical fact that Dr. Kelly took his life, when that is precisely the claim which Mr. Baker disputes. But my main gripe, of course, is with you, Mr. Rentall. You say that Norman Baker's book, The Strange Death of David Kelly, is about a theory that is so outlandish and so ridiculous that nobody can take it seriously. But that is very hard to believe when, according to its page at Amazon.co.uk, the book enjoys a star rating of 4.3 over 5 out of 55 reviews, and in the product description reviews, Nigel Jones of the Sunday Telegraph is prepared to say that it's a stunning work of non-fiction, a meticulous account, and a courageous and well-publicised probing into Kelly's death. And the Sunday Times review that it's a superb summation of all the evidence, and the Evening Standard that it may make uncomfortable reading for certain politicians and members of the intelligence community, but it is likely to persuade many that there was far more to the death of David Kelly than has been revealed. Now, as I said, I've not read it, and I'm happy to believe that I wouldn't agree with everything that's in it. But that it's so outlandish and so ridiculous that nobody can take it seriously, I think is itself clearly a statement that is so outlandish and so ridiculous that nobody ought to take it seriously. But then you admit, you haven't read it anyway.
I haven't actually read his ridiculous book about David Kelly because I don't read books. I don't waste my time on books about UFOs or JFK, but...
So may I ask you, Mr. Rentall, how is it that you think anyone should take what you say seriously when you're prepared to condemn a book that you haven't actually read? And by mentioning UFOs, which, of course, immediately connotes speculations about little green men in spaceships visiting us from the planet Zog, am I to understand that you really think that questions about the death of Dr. David Kelly and President John F. Kennedy are in the same evidential class as aliens? But then, as you say, you don't read books like this, nor presumably do you listen to quality investigative reporting on the subject, such as James Corbett's investigation at CorbettReport.com, Requiem for the Suicided, Dr. David Kelly, which, if anything does, makes it abundantly clear that there is indeed much that is suspicious about that death. But as you say, you don't have to consult anything like that because someone has done all the work for you.
David Aronovich has written an excellent book on conspiracy theories and has read it for us, doing a sterling public service.
Yes, David Aronovich in his book Voodoo Histories, How Conspiracy Theory Has Shaped Modern History. Now, while this is yet another book that I haven't read from cover to cover, I did rather cheekily, read quite enough of it one afternoon in a bookstore to be able to say with a reasonably high degree of confidence that in writing it, David Aronovich has neither provided us with an excellent book, as you put it, nor has he done us all a sterling public service, as you also put it. And let me note in passing that this is the same Mr. Aronovich who, in an article in The Guardian in April 2003, said that if Iraqi weapons of mass destruction were never found, quote, I will never believe another thing that I'm told by our government, or that of the US, ever again. And, more to the point, neither will anyone else. Those weapons had better be there somewhere. But I digress. But what concerns me, Mr. Rentoul, most is what you say here.
This is the way that conspiracy theorists work. They suggest, oh no, I wasn't suggesting that. I was merely asking questions. I mean, this is absolutely not the way that serious people should do business.
So let me ask, what do you mean by the term conspiracy theorist? Do you just mean a person who forms hypotheses with respect to collaborative, clandestine and illegal acts? Or are you using it euphemistically to mean something like a crazy person? It seems to me you cannot mean it in the first sense, because then you would be dismissing the work of every detective, every forensic scientist, and indeed the entire intelligence establishment, whom you feel Mr. Baker will so poorly serve, because, of course, it is precisely their job to form such hypotheses. No, it seems to me you must therefore mean it in the second sense. But then you're just insulting Mr. Baker. And indeed, you're insulting everyone else who dares to ask questions about topics that you consider to be outside the proper sphere of rational inquiry. But why should I trust you as a reliable judge as to what we should and should not ask questions about? After all, to repeat, you are by your own admission someone who condemns a book without even reading it. And of course, had people been put off only asking questions, as you put it, out of fear of being branded a conspiracy theorist in the sense that you seem to be using it, the world would never have known about MK Ultra, Operation Northwoods, Operation Mockingbird, Watergate, the Iran-Contra affair, the Tuskegee syphilis study, or to quote Glenn Greenwald, the Pentagon Papers, the My Lai massacre, the network of CIA black sites in which detainees were tortured, the NSA warrantless eavesdropping program, the documents negating claims of Iraqi WMDs, or a whole litany of waste, corruption, and illegality that once bore the top secret label. No, it seems to me that you are simply insulting Mr. Baker, and millions of others around the world whom you consider to be cognitively compromised in some way, presumably because they ask indelicate questions about the state. Which leads me to my final question. And I'm well aware that you will consider what I'm about to say deeply ironic, and that you will no doubt accuse me of being just the kind of conspiracy theorist you so delight to ridicule. But that's no problem to me. Let me play with your sense of irony. So here's what I want to ask you. Could it be, Mr. Rentoul, that it is you, rather than Mr. Baker, who is cognitively compromised? Could it be that when you use the term conspiracy theorist in the way that you do, you show yourself to be a victim of psychological engineering? For we now know that it was the CIA that weaponized that term, in its derogatory sense, to function precisely as a thought stopper, to dissuade people from questioning the Warren Report. And as a thought stopper, it has functioned ever since. So with that thought in mind, I beg your indulgence for a few minutes, and I invite you to sit back and listen to the words of Mark Crispin Miller. Because what he has to say, I think, should give all of us, but particularly you, Mr. Rentoul, considerable pause for thought.
Conspiracy theory. Think about that. Conspiracy theory functions as a most effective cudgel against anyone who tries even to discuss a certain range of stories, right? Conspiracy theory. You call somebody a conspiracy theorist, and you have very effectively neutralized them. Once a journalist, for example, gets to be defined as a conspiracy theorist, or professor, public intellectual, anybody, that person has been neutralized. And I would suggest that it's actually a much more efficient way to silence people than to have some goon come, you know, to their house at night and pop them. You know, it's a really clean, safe way to prevent people from listening to what you have to say. Now, the other day, I was privileged to moderate a press conference on the 9/11 subject, and one of our speakers was Lieutenant Colonel Shelton Lankford, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Marines, flew a lot of missions in Vietnam. He's part of the military community speaking out for a new investigation of 9/11, and he began by noting that his personal hero was Smedley Darlington Butler, right? Okay. Who was, as many of you appear to know, you know, a Marine general who, you know, I mean, his military record is constantly invoked in textbooks and curricula used to teach soldiers and officers how to fight and how to command and so on. But he's also famous for having blown the whistle on the so-called business plot in the 30s. Is a group of plutocrats, rich people, who asked him to function as the man on the white horse to lead an army of outraged veterans to Washington and depose Franklin Roosevelt and take over as dictator. And he actually blew the whistle on this, went to Congress and talked about it. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Lankford's point, which I think was extremely well taken, was that if Butler had stepped forward and said this today, he'd be dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. Okay? I think that's obviously true. But that raises the crucial question, when did this phrase suddenly become the means of choice for defining the all-important boundary line between conspiracy theories that we can all believe in, right? Like the official explanation of 9/11 or the international communist conspiracy. And those conspiracy theories that you know, by definition, we just aren't supposed to talk about. When did this happen? So I did some research. And I can tell you exactly when it happened. It happened in the mid to late 60s. All right? And I have some documentary evidence. If you do a search on the phrase conspiracy theory in the New York Times archives, you find that it's rarely used until that moment. And if you do a search at time.com, Time Magazine, you'll find it's never used until that moment. Then it's used all the time. Okay? And I would suggest to you that the reason it becomes so frequent in journalistic circles is that this is going to sound like a conspiracy theory. that's the beauty of the tactic, isn't it? Right? But there is no doubt, because here is a declassified CIA memo that you can all get online. Thank God for the internet, right? It is number 104-10404. 10376. It was dated January 4th, 1967, and it's sent out to all station chiefs worldwide about our concern. Our concern is that from the day of President Kennedy's assassination, there has been speculation about the responsibility for his murder. Okay? Specifically, there are a number of books that had just come out or were about to come out questioning the conclusions of the Warren Commission report. And the two books that most concerned the CIA were Mark Lane's A Rush to Judgment and Edward J. Epstein's Inquest. And let me say, by the way, that I'm not standing here telling you that everything in those books was great. I'm not even standing here giving you my own view on the Kennedy assassination. I'm not doing that any more than we're here to say we know 9/11 was an inside job. It's not the point. It's putting the cart before the horse. I'm simply pointing out that the CIA used its resources in a deliberate and systematic way to impugn these authors and these books. And you got to get a hold of this memo, because it indicates point by point precisely how the agency should use its friends in the press to attack these books. I'll read you a couple of examples. It'll sound very familiar to you. Okay? Anyway, the mission is to employ propaganda assets to answer and refute the attacks of the critics. Okay? That's the first sentence in that paragraph. They elaborate on it. But here are the points they advise making. No significant new evidence has emerged which the commission did not consider. They go on and on. That's A. B, critics usually overvalue particular items and ignore others. Okay? C, conspiracy on the large scale often suggested would be impossible to conceal in the United States, especially since informants could expect to receive large royalties, etc. D, critics have often been enticed by a form of intellectual pride. They light on some theory and fall in love with it. They also scoff at the commission. I could go on. I urge you to read it yourselves. I'm simply suggesting that conspiracy theory became so current and a kind of a reflexive term for dismissing these kinds of counterarguments when it did with the help of the CIA, which is to say, with the help of the covert arm of the American government. Now, if you flash forward to the present, you'll see that the same basic rules are used to dismiss the work of, say, David Ray Griffin. Although I have to add that they never, ever actually grapple with any of the specifics in his books. Right? Never. It's just a kind of vague, snickering dismissal of anybody who would believe in this kind of thing, and a tendency to seize on some of the wackier assertions that some of the people affiliated with this movement have made, right? Because there are some. And then say, oh, look, they say that. Well, obviously, the whole thing is a bunch of you see? Now, this response, see, this press response has been used in many cases over the last few decades. I mean, there's the Kennedy assassination. Okay, it's conspiracy theory to argue with the claim that it was a lone gunman, etc. But the exact same arguments were used, and this will take some of us back, to dismiss the story of the October surprise, which involved the Reagan team meeting with the Iranians secretly during the 1980 presidential campaign to persuade them to hang on to the hostages long enough to get Ronald Reagan into the White House.
I wrote that book.
God bless you. And you're obviously nuts. Barbara Honegger, also Gary Sick. Let me say parenthetically that the journalist Robert Parry has been covering this carefully, and his website is consortiumnews.com, and the story of the October surprise is beyond argument true. All subsequent discoveries of evidence have borne it out. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's not a speculation. It's not that there's no evidence to support it. There is now abundant evidence to support it, but no one will revisit it. So it remains etched in the mass mind, which includes all of us or most of us, as just an unfounded rumor. Okay? Flight TWA-800. Very different kind of story, and Christina Borgeson was here yesterday to talk. Did she talk about that at all?
Yes, no.
Yes, no. Well, okay. Well, you know, in her book, Into the Buzzsaw, which I strongly recommend to all of you, there are no fewer than three essays on that tragedy in 1996. And these journalists' careers were ruined simply for having noted the evidence that that plane crashed as a result of a naval exercise gone wrong. In other words, it was an accident, and the Navy was responsible for that accident. That's what the evidence seems to suggest. But simply for pursuing the evidence, these journalists' lives were destroyed, their careers, I should say, were destroyed. But importantly, it was conspiracy theory. This was a conspiracy theory. Anyone who talks about it is a conspiracy theorist, you see? The CIA's drug smuggling. It's a story that was broken by Gary Webb. And as one, I'll get there, step by step, although you all know that he is dead. As one man, the mainstream media jumped on him and attacked him as a conspiracy theorist, as someone who had not made his case, who'd made this stuff up. They imputed positions to him that he hadn't taken. They said he was saying they deliberately addicted black Americans to crack cocaine to keep them weak. He never said any such thing. And then when the CIA's own Inspector General's report came out a little bit later, he realized, yeah, I got the story wrong. I'd vastly understated it. It was actually worse than I thought. He wrote a book about it called Dark Alliance, which got no reviews. He is now dead. He killed himself. No. Well, maybe not. All right, he's dead. He may not have killed himself. But let's not get pedantic, okay? Take my point? The point is that it is extremely dangerous professionally to a reporter to go into the territory where they've set up a lot of signs that say conspiracy theory, keep out. The Oklahoma City bombing, okay? I could go on and on with more of these kind of lurid examples, but let me give you one that's not so lurid, which is a story that has sort of consumed me for the last several years, and that's the evidence of widespread and continuing election fraud primarily by the Republican Party, okay? That this stuff has gone on, there is no doubt that it has happened time and time again in election after election from 2000 on a scale previously unimaginable even to the most corrupt politicians in our history, including Mayor Daley from my hometown of Chicago and Lyndon Johnson and other corrupt Democrats. What we've been witnessing really is a profound misrepresentation of our own collective will, that Americans, most progressives, most liberals, all liberals, believe that to talk about this is delusional. It's conspiracy theory. It's insane. And it's a view that Obama shares and the Democrats in Congress share. So that even as we speak, I mean, we're right in the midst of part of the groundwork for more electoral theft this November. Because the Tea Party's numbers and influence have been constantly exaggerated, you see? And I could tell you chapter and verse about recent elections or recent occurrences in various states that are not just fishy, but impossible. But that would take me off the subject. What I'm trying to suggest to you is this, okay? I'm raising this question. Conspiracy theory springs so easily to the lips of so many reporters and to their fingertips as they work at the word processor for a range of reasons, okay? A range of reasons. There are the things that Joe talked about at the beginning. Journalism is in crisis. People are scared of losing their jobs. The last thing in the world you want to do is take some kind of a risk that might define you as a crackpot. So it's best to stay away from this stuff. See? There's also the fact that investigative reporting, as Joe says, is extremely expensive. It's not really cost effective. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of money. Nobody will commit to that. And there are various other factors involved in the collapse of mainstream journalism. But I would suggest that the kind of intellectual timorousness, kind of civic cowardice that's involved here in shutting one's eyes to copious and specific evidence of these kinds of crimes can be helped along as well. See? And I would suggest that the kind of effort that the CIA made back in the late 60s to encourage their media assets to attack these writers for going too far, I don't think that necessarily ever stopped. You see? I think that kind of thing still goes on. So this is what I would urge, okay? This is what I would urge today. We all have a tendency to marry ourselves to particular causes, don't we? Yes. I mean, I suppose everybody in the room here is probably pretty deeply committed to the 9/11 question. I know I am. But I've noticed that people tend to become a little bit protective of their cause. And I've heard people say, they've written to me to say, you know, I mean, I know you think election fraud is an important subject, and of course it is, but 9/11 is the real story. 9/11 is the real story, okay? Like, the fact that they stole the election that got them into a position to do that in the first place is immaterial. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is 9/11. Now, contrarily, I've had people say to me, you know, those 9/11 people, excuse me. Those 9/11 people, I mean, you know, they're so busy, they're so over-focused on that. I mean, they don't look at the October surprise, for example. And that was crucial because that made Reagan president. That introduced the whole neocon movement. All right, the point here is that we cannot be this sectarian about all this. We have to be rational and we have to be patriotic and keep our minds open to the possibility that all these stories are important and all related, you know? Because we're talking about a sustained attack on American democracy. That's what we're talking about. A sustained, highly sophisticated attack on American democracy. This, okay, does not mean that we have to believe every conspiracy theory that comes along, because some of them are berserk. I mean, there are crazy people out there. Maybe the CIA is paying some of them. Now, who knows? But the fact is, it is extremely difficult to keep a clear sense of the distinction between truth and falsehood. It takes study. It takes work. It takes caution. It takes care. But it is necessary to do that, and it is necessary always to do what you all are doing and what Lenny and his team are doing and what we're all trying to do, which is to make sure that the American people finally hear that what they do, in fact, often suspect or intuit is based on facts. Okay? Because it is not the case that everybody out there is tottering around like zombies with their heads filled with the 9/11 Commission report. They don't all buy that. You know, when somebody like Jesse Ventura comes out with a book that has a whole chapter on this and on the theft of the 2004 election, by the way, and it becomes a bestseller, although it gets no reviews, this means that people are listening, right? So that seems to me to be our job, is to find ways to tell people that what they have a hunch is the case is probably the case. And these are the reasons why. And this is where the scientific evidence comes in. This is where the archival evidence comes in. This is where the technical evidence of election fraud comes in. The eyewitness reports come in and all the rest of it. Because ultimately, as corny as this sounds, we are really fighting for truth and democracy, which is to say our freedom and self-government. And there's no reason to apologize for that. And that's not a conspiracy theory, okay? Thank you.
And for more information about the source of that recording of journalist Mark Crispin Miller's address, please visit the radio show 9/11 Wake Up Call at the University of Hartford, www.uh.org. Next week, we shall, all being well, be speaking to Dr. Daniele Ganser about Operation Gladio. He is a Swiss historian and the author of NATO's Secret Armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe. And a couple of weeks after that, I should be speaking to the biochemist Dr. Michael J. Behe, who is author of the famous book Darwin's Black Box, which was one of the main books that helped to launch the intelligent design movement, as it's become known. So all that remains is for me to say thank you for listening to this podcast from themindrenewed.com, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.